Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory 87. Bill Russell passed on Sunday morning. Saw the tweet come through from his wife, from his family, that they put out a great statement on his life, his impact, and been kind of planning ahead, looking forward to this day for quite a while, especially over at CLNS Media, where we do a lot of the history stuff, the history vault that Nick runs, ton of Bill Russell content up over on Celtics All Access as well. The statement they put out, Bill Russell, the most prolific winner in American sports history, passed away peacefully today at age 88 with his wife Janine by his side. Arrangements for his memorial service will be announced soon. 2 state championships in high school, incomparable run of pure team accomplishment. To come twice an NCAA champion, captain of a gold medal U.S. Olympic team, 11 times an NBA champion. But the off-court stuff, obviously front and center. Boycotting a 61 exhibition game to unmask too long tolerated discrimination, to leading Mississippi's first integrated basketball camp in the wake of Medgar Evans' assassination, to decades of activism, ultimately recognized by his receipt of the Presidential Medal of Honor. Bill called out injustice with an unforgiving candor that he intended would disrupt the status quo, with a powerful example that, though never his humble intention, will forever inspire teamwork, selflessness, and thoughtful change. So, quite a number of tributes out there. One of them from our guest today is still yet to come as we record this on Friday. Bob Ryan has a Boston Globe article coming on Sunday. Got to know Bill throughout his coaching and broadcasting career after he finished, as Bob was starting the Celtics beat the year after Bill retired, 1970. So we're going to talk to him here today. He, of course, did a tribute as well over on the Ryan and Goodman podcast that you should go check out. Really no one better to talk to. Well, you know, Cedric Maxwell had a great tribute as well, and others who have played with him have certainly spoken out, and a number of those players have passed at this point. Casey Jones, Sam Jones died about a year ago. Tommy Heinsohn, of course. So, unfortunately, a lot of those guys' perspectives have been lost, and Bill kind of carried that torch. He was pretty active the last couple of years, and over the last decade or so, handing out the NBA Finals MVP award. He, of course, did not appear in person at his Hall of Fame induction, his second Hall of Fame induction as a coach, which I believe was a year or two ago at this point. So that visible presence around the game that Bill provided had kind of faded, especially into the pandemic, which was too bad. And now, of course, there's an unmatched presence that will be lost forever. But, of course, his impact will be felt forever. Just an incredible legacy, really an unmatched legacy in sports history among great freedom fighters as well as champions. Really, Muhammad Ali, Jackie Robinson, Bill Russell, those are guys that you can mention in the same breath at the top level of achievement in this sport. So, of course, rest in peace to Bill Russell. We're going to talk about some stories Bob has from getting to know him over the years, go over that long list of accomplishments, and get Bob's perspective on it here. I'm really excited to do that. We, of course, talked to Bob last for the last dance there in 2020, so can't wait for this one. I think you're all really going to enjoy it. And, of course, there's been a million different Russell tributes out there, and hopefully this one has at least one thing that no one else was able to provide. So enjoy that. Of course, we're brought to you by betonline.ag. Go over there, support the program, support CLNS Media, and use the code CLNS50 to get 50% back on your first deposit. Anything you're looking into betting, I know NFL just came back with the Hall of Fame game last night. And of course, there's plenty of preseason games to come. NFL football finally back, and all the action, futures, props, live bets, odds, and information, it's available at betonline.ag, where I'm always going to check out the latest betting information, as well as just sports information as a whole. They have a great site. I always enjoy just scrolling through it, seeing what I can find over there. And of course, they have everything, whether it's baseball, night in and night out, fights, golf, basketball, futures you can start to look into and plan. You already have championship odds out. Celtics still the prohibitive favorite at plus 400 despite the declining Kevin Durant noise over the last couple weeks here. It doesn't seem like those trade talks have really gone anywhere since. But Celtics still standing apart. And as far as over-unders go, still among the top teams heading into 2023. So go over there, see what you like, check out the website. And of course, if you use the code CLNS50, you'll really be supporting CLNS, Garden Report, Dome Theory, all the great content and coverage we bring you throughout the season. And of course, we appreciate them as well. Great site, betonline.ag. What also brings your favorite Vegas casino games? A little bit of everything over at betonline.ag. That's CLNS50 when you first sign up. BetOnline, where the game starts. It says Dome Theory 87. We have Bob Ryan waiting. So let's get to our conversation with the legend, Bob Ryan. Here he is.
Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory number 87 here on CLNS Media. And our guest needs no introduction. The great Bob Ryan is here. Bob, welcome in. Appreciate you being back here. I talked to you a couple of years ago about The Last Dance, Michael Jordan, and now a much more somber episode with Bill Russell passing at 88. And quite a number of tributes have been done throughout the week. I saw an old article you wrote in the Globe ran this week, and who better to talk to than someone who watched his career, someone who, as you said earlier this week, got to know him personally when he was coaching in Seattle and his life after basketball there. So when you look back on Bill, there's a million different things we can say about him. The civil rights activist, the coach, of course, who ended up making the Hall of Fame, player coach with the Celtics, and then, of course, the 11-time championship career that he had. Of all those things, what do you think is his biggest legacy when you're looking back on his life?
You're going to divide it. There's two major aspects, the personal and the achievements. And obviously, in the long run, the personal, the stature, the fight against racism, the way he handled his entire life. And it's encapsulated in a credo that he had. It was very brief, but very telling. And that was as follows. It's a quote. He said, "My citizenship is not a gift, it's a birthright," and unquote. And by that, he meant that he did not need a validation of white America to do anything, whether it was where he's going to eat or sleep or whether he could vote or whatever he wanted to do. That wasn't, he should have had the same rights as any American, as should all Black people and all Asian people, all people who were born in America. And that was the way he lived. And he lived in a straightforward manner and did it what he wanted. You know, you talk about my ways, he did it his way. That's ultimately more important. Bill Russell, the great American. Of course, he's known because he was a great basketball player. And one of the things that I'm gratified that I've seen this week, it'll never do proper justice to him, but because of all the stuff that's being people are being reminded about how great he was and why he should be remembered as a basketball player, that's good because as time goes on, people always embrace the new and especially in basketball, they talk about athleticism and they think, you know, with the 3-point shot and the athleticism at the game is better. It's different. There are more good athletes. I'm not going to deny that. There's no question. But some people are ahead of their time. And Bill Russell was one of those people in life and in basketball. More than any player in the history of the game, he was ahead of his time and athletically. And dominated the way he did for two reasons. One was his athleticism, and two, his intelligence. He always was the smartest guy on the floor, always. And in terms of how to play the game and what was going on and psychology, everything else. So I'm glad that people are hearing about it now. New people are hearing about it. They're, you know, because he would be lumped in with, oh yeah, maybe he's one of the top 10 players. No. He's the most important player in the history of the game in terms of how the game is influencing the game. Period.
The most impressive thing I read about him is his college days. He's playing there at San Francisco and he's playing I want you to put it into context just how he innovated basketball, innovated defense, because one of the things he said is that his coach at San Francisco didn't like the way he was playing defense in terms of playing back, blocking shots, protecting the rim. you almost wonder just how he came up with that style. It was his athleticism. It was his length, I'd assume. And that gave him the advantage of being able to block shots around the rim. But he legitimately changed the way teams play defense.
Before Bill Russell, there may have been occasional block shots, but the idea of a center was offensively oriented. You know, George Mikan had been voted the greatest player of the first half century. And George Mikan was a 6'10", burly, strong, plodding guy with a great hook shot and power moves, you know, power to the basket. But defensively, he wasn't known, but he didn't play. And he was a good rebounder. You know, yes. In the time, he's a good rebounder, very good rebounder. But it didn't. And defensively, it wasn't played that way. You're right. And I love that. I'm amused to think that Phil Woolpert, that's the name of the coach, by the way, Phil Woolpert would tell Russell, stay on the floor. You know, Russell had a different idea. Russell truly revolutionized the concept of how to play defense as a big man. He gave me a line in 1999. I introduced the vertical game to basketball, quote unquote. Now, that's a very boastful statement. It also happens to be accurate. And there was nobody like him before that. Nobody. He is a trendsetter. And so one of the things that's interesting to me over the year is that all the thousands of big men that have come along since he first appeared on the scene in San Francisco in the mid-50s, you know, and I know, and our viewers know that all too often, some preening guy blocks a shot, knocks it into the 10th row. The other team gets the ball back and they score.
We've seen it with Robert Williams early in his career.
that's more prevalent than not. Okay. This is 65 years later. They're still doing it. Bill Russell didn't do that. Bill Russell's goal, he didn't succeed every time because no one could, but very often his goal was to keep the ball and play with the block and start a fast break. That was the goal. That was the intention. And now you couldn't do that every time. And there were certain types of blocks. And obviously just the idea was just block the damn shot. But whenever he could, he kept the ball in play. And he did it, I'm telling you, better than anyone ever has before. And of course, nobody before. So better than anyone ever has, more consistently. Tom Heinsohn had a way of describing it. He used to tell me, he said he popped it. I don't know exactly what that means, but you know, he had it. He was dexterous enough and athletic enough after we had this extraordinary high leap and this quick jump and this timing to keep the ball in play with his hand-eye coordination as well. And he was so far ahead of his time. No, I don't even know who you could compare him with today. You know, who's the most closest facsimile? I don't know, but I know that Bill Russell could come into today's game and do those things that he did as well as he did them then.
The only name I could throw out there is Draymond. And like, it's probably not even the same degree.
Yeah, but no, Draymond, I like Draymond, but he's more of a, you know what? He's more compared to Rodman. He's more like Rodman. And he's that's not his game. He's got a different kind of game. It's a very
smart. He's not much of a shot block. He's more ground down.
I think he's a Hall of Famer in his own way. That's the same way that Rodman was. But not that kind of player. No.
I do want to get to Rodman.
Shot blockers. Yeah, I mean, Rudy Gobert is a shot blocker.
Gobert is a great shot blocker.
I'm here to tell you, he said he's not Bill Russell. He's a fine shot blocker in 2022. Congratulations. You may be the best guy in the league. I'm here to tell you, you're not Bill Russell.
So that's the interesting thing about Russell is they didn't have blocks back then. And I saw one person did a study that estimated that he might have had as many as 8 blocks per game back then. I don't know how true that would have been, but given the amount of shots that went up and all that stuff, it could have been.
The same is true with Wilt.
Yeah.
The block shot was not a stat. The ABA, one of the good things about the ABA, you know, they brought in stats, including blocks and steals, which the NBA wasn't using, and offensive rebound differentiation. That wasn't they weren't differentiated in the NBA. Uh-huh. Certain times, certain writers at certain times would do it them on their own, you know, but it wasn't an official stat. But we'll never know about Russell and Chamberlain. And we got to put Wilt in this conversation of as being a dominant person in this regard too, but he wasn't Bill Russell either. In that regard of keeping the ball in play or, but anyway, we will never know. And then, like with all good shot blockers, even today, this is one thing that's never changed. We also will never know about the discouragement of shots. You know, the shots that aren't taken because they're afraid of the shot blocker. That's always been part of the deal. It was part of the deal with Russell. And it's part of the deal today, just as it was 65 years ago.
That's probably the great mystery of that time. You don't have video of Wilt's 100-point game. You don't have the block totals. It's just a lot that has to be kind of passed down and, you know, told by people like you.
Yeah, you got anecdotal evidence of those of us who actually lived through this thing. But I'll be honest, we don't know. But I tell you, it would have been an astonishing number of blocks. And you're right. There were more shots taken and missed. And in general, more shots were taken as a rule. You pretty much every team wanted to take in when he came in the league, 100 shots a game. Today, you don't ever see any team ever taking 100 shots a game.
Now, I want to get into that draft story of him, because, of course, you mentioned Heinsohn. They draft him as the territorial pick that they had back then, and Casey Jones, his college teammate. But this story of how they drafted him, so they had been really good the year before, right? So they didn't have a great pick.
They were not in the playoffs, but clearly they needed something else. They were bridesmaids, mm-hmm. clearly.
Yeah, they didn't have a pick good enough to get, you know, the number one or number two guy in this draft class. He ends up going number two to the Hawks, who were in St. Louis at the time. And the story, I want to ask you, like, how true this legend that gets passed down about the ice capades, and it was Rochester, right, that had the number one pick. They had a big man at the time, and the Celtics owner offered them the ice capades to not draft Russell, is how the story is told.
It is 100% true. Lester Harrison was an owner of the Rochester Royals, and he also owned the arena, he had the first pick, and Walter Brown and Red, through Red, you know, offered him the ice capade dates. I don't know how many. He would not draft Bill Russell if he would draft someone else. And he drafted Cy Hugo Green of Duke. That's number one. And then number two, the St. Louis Hawks they didn't draft Russell. The Celtics made a trade with them to get that right, their rights, mm-hmm. because St. Louis did not want a black player. Now, St. Louis was then, quote unquote, the northernmost southern city in America. That's the way it was known by the Americans. And they weren't ready for a black player. So they weren't going to draft Bill Russell. So that was an easier one. And they had something to offer Ed McCauley, who was an all-star player for the Celtics, center, but not a great rebounder, a scorer, a very skinny finesse player. He happened to be from St. Louis. He had played for the St. Louis Billikens and was a local hero. And they were very happy to get him in this trade. And they also got the rights to Cliff Hagan coming out of the Army, who turned out to be a very fine NBA player, not a Hall of Fame NBA level player, but an all-star level player, a terrific 6'4 guy who could really play. And it was an all-American at Kentucky. He was in the Army and he came out of the Army and he was part of the deal too. So yes, the ice capade story is the gospel truth.
It's really incredible to think about. And so the Celtics, they put this great team together year one. They end up playing the Hawks in the finals.
Yeah.
Year one, right? And they end up.
It's a good deal for the Hawks. It goes seven games, it goes double overtime, first game, double overtime, second game, and seventh game.
Three rookies end up being the centerpiece of that team, and Russell, Heinsohn, and Heinsohn actually wins rookie of the year that year.
Yeah.
How was the team able to just come together that well right away with those three players?
All right, we'll start with the fact that Heinsohn was, they got two great number ones because they had the so-called every team had a chance for a territorial draft pick, and Tommy Heinsohn was the Celtics. That doesn't exist anymore. Of course, it didn't exist for much longer, but it did exist in 1956, and they got Tommy Heinsohn because they had the rights to him if they wanted to exercise it from Holy Cross down the road. Okay. And they have Russell. Russell then goes to the Olympics, which were in December. So he doesn't join the team until the week before Christmas in 1956. And by the time he joined the team, they were already in first place, in large measure because Heinsohn was playing great, as well as Cousy and Charman were the best backcourt in the NBA. Jumbo Jelmaskutov had proven himself to be a great rebounder. They had some components, and Russell put them over the top. St. Louis was happy with their end of it. They took, you know, they came damn close. They go seventh game, double overtime, and against the Celtics. It was a great series.
Of course, here on Dome Theory, brought to you by Athletic Greens. Athletic Greens, we've been telling you about it on the Garden Report. What is it? One scoop every morning in your water, you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source ingredients, probiotics, adaptogens. It's got a little bit of everything that you could get in various different locations, but with this product, you just one scoop every morning. You get the travel packs, which I'm going to tell you about in just a minute, and makes it easy to get all the nutrition, all the gut health, all the different things you need to set a healthy basis for yourself every day and taste good. That's the most important thing. Some of these green juices and other stuff, it has a funky flavor that's tough to get in a rhythm of taking. Well, this one's got a nice tropical flavor that's really enjoyable. People love this. You don't even have to believe me. Go to the reviews. Just check out how popular Athletic Greens is. And cost you less than $3 a day. Go get a subscription. They're going to give you a cool bottle. They're going to give you a container to hold it in. Great green theme. Celtics. Big Celtics fan. It fits into that. And to make it easy, they're going to give you 1 free year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your purchase. All you have to do is go to athleticgreens.com/garden. That's athleticgreens.com/garden. Take ownership of your health and pick up the ultimate nutritional insurance while supporting the Garden Report, Dome Theory, and CLNS Media. So go check that out, athleticgreens.com/garden. You talked about the fast break, which is really what made those Celtics teams special back then. They put those into play. Fred's coaching it. Russell's kind of key in it. You talked about the shot block and all those different things that made that happen. But just how revolutionary was the fast break at that time?
Well, it was, they were fast break. I mean, Auerbach loved to run, but he didn't get the ball often enough because he didn't have a great rebounder. That was why they wanted Russell. He saw in Russell that he was the guy. He definitely identified from what he was tipped off to him. He saw him. Oh my God, this is the guy. There were teams that wanted to run, but nobody ran. The Celtics, they at that time became the premier running team because they had all the components, starting with Russell to get the ball. And the best middleman to orchestrate the fast break was Cousy. And not only then, but, you know, he's the gold standard for all time about how to run a fast break. And they had a well-orchestrated fast break. And they had Heinsohn would run the wing, and Frank Ramsey would run the wing, and Bill Sharman, who was a great shooter, would be the trailer. And they had a very organized, efficient fast break, but it would always be, but they couldn't get it done very often, often enough without the ball, which Russell's came and got them.
And Russell, the teammate, obviously eventually becomes that player coach, but you read about it, he didn't get along with everybody, especially Tommy. And one of the things that seemed to be a point of contention between them was that rookie of the year, Bill looking at it, saying maybe he deserved it. Tommy ended up winning that. And they didn't have the greatest relationship throughout their careers, it seemed, but the team itself came together.
Well, I'm not aware of this friction that you allude to.
Mm-hmm. That's
I'm not aware of that. So I'm sorry. Hell, I knew Tommy very well, but quite well. I mean, for a long time. I don't ever remember him saying anything like that to me.
What did Tommy have to say about Russell
I never heard him say a bad word about Russell. Period. Mm-hmm. I never heard. I don't know where you heard that, because I have never heard that from Heinsohn or Cousy or Russell himself or Red or anybody ever. Never heard that.
You would know better than me, so maybe that's erroneous that I'm throwing out there.
I don't know. Where do you? I'm not even going to ask you where you got it, but I've never heard it. So maybe I'm a naive, but I've never heard that. I've never heard Tom Heinsohn, all those years I knew him, say anything remotely disparaging or any negative thing about Russell in any way, ever.
All right, well, let's move on to the Lexington boycott. That story, Russell, I believe it was Sat Sanders as well, and a couple other players were refused service down in Kentucky.
Oh, yeah.
They end up saying, we're flying home. Red effectively said, you know, he didn't think it was the best idea in the world, but he supported them. And they end up boycotting that game, which ended up becoming a bit of a landmark moment, not only in NBA history, but in, civil rights history at the time in Kentucky there.
Yeah, and of course, the thing is that the issue over and above that it was done at all, it was Frank Ramsey's home deal, you know, and they were all very fond of Frank. And, you know, they didn't want Frank to be embarrassed at home either, you know, so that was part of the dynamic of that whole thing. And, so, yeah, but it happened. It's all true. Now's the times, a totally different world, and in that regard. But Russell was always in the forefront of human rights he never backed down. Mm-hmm.
And the battles with Wilt, the thing that came to define him there. Wilt, you know, one of the most explosive stat stuffers of all time. And you just look at his stat lines that he'd have from game to game and season to season, the 50 point per game season, which is just unimaginable. And just how physically imposing he was as a 7'1" guy at the time. What made Russell so effective? He won 2/3 of the games against them. All the big moments it felt like he overcame, except for the one series against Philadelphia. And, you know, he ultimately was the one who took this matchup more often than not. But Will, with all that dominance offensively, what made Bill so effective against him?
As Russell, explained to everybody and once to me, he gave up 4 inches, 40 pounds. Wilt was an equally good athlete. There was one exceptional difference about him. And Russell, in terms of rebounding, is that Wilt was a gatherer. Wilt had to flex and launch, whereas Russell would boom, take off without any kind of flex. But Russ tried to use his lateral mobility to get Wilt to move side to side more than he wanted to. Wilt wasn't that great laterally. Wilt was great north-south. He wasn't great east-west. Russell was extraordinary east-west, as well as north-south. And that's the only edge he had. And psychology, too. And sometimes when he knew he could block a Wilt shot, he wouldn't do it, but he'd wait until it was the fourth quarter and then do it. You know what I mean? And he did that with people all the time. He used psychology as well as any center has ever used psychology. But the ultimate difference, as I remember him explaining it, to me, is his lateral mobility. But, you know, sometimes it wasn't enough. But you're right. They played. Here's the thing. You made an allusion to the 2/3 of the games, which is true. I love pointing out to people, Larry and Magic, everybody knows that, you know, they felt in our time, in just recent time, that was a great rivalry, right? Okay. They played 31 times ultimately. That's all they played against each other, including playoffs. 31. Wilt and Russell played 142 times against each other, not including exhibitions. And in those days, they actually played 15 or 20 exhibitions. although I just saw the Celtics schedule come out today with 4.
Yeah.
They would play 15 to 20. Everybody would. So, you know, they had played Philadelphia, if that's true, over the 10-year period with their careers overlap, probably 20 more times at minimum in exhibitions. But they played officially 142 times. Russell's teams called the Celtics 185 of them, and Wilt's teams called A, the Warriors in Philadelphia, B, the Warriors in San Francisco, C, the 76ers in Philadelphia, and D, the Lakers in Los Angeles, 157, 85 for Russ, 657 for Wilt. Now, did by and large Russ have more good players on his team? Yes. That much better? No, at times. And the year that Philly really had a team, the Wagon was 66-67, you alluded to that, they beat them fair and square. And in the fifth game, elimination game in Philadelphia, Wilt went for 29 points, 36 rebounds, and 13 assists. And that was Wilt's first. It was two back-to-back years in which he averaged 24 points, 24 rebounds, and 8 assists, and led the league in assists as he was trying to reinvent himself, you know? But it was a great, there's nothing even in second place for the best rivalry compared when you figure they played 142 times.
Yeah, and the friendship there is a really cool story. They'd go out to dinner and all that different kind of stuff. But then it comes to, I believe it was the last series that they played between each other in 1969, I believe it was, between the Lakers and Celtics there. And Wilt goes down with the injury. And, you know, I had my erroneous point of contention earlier, but this is a real point of contention between these two, Wilt and Russ. And they didn't talk for, what was it, decades after this moment where Wilt goes out of the game with a knee injury, or I believe it was an Achilles injury in the end there.
Russ couldn't resist piling on at the moment, which I know he really regretted. And he did say something about he wouldn't have come out of the game and all, you know, maybe he didn't know at that moment. I'm not sure exactly what, you know, in the immediate time frame after the game, when exactly he said this famous quote, you know, 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, what did he know about what really happened with Wilt and Von Bredikoff, that Wilt wanted to come back in and Von Bredikoff wouldn't let him come back in? He said, we were doing okay without you, as Melch Counts was hitting some jump shots, you know. I don't know what Russell knew and when he knew it. However, it's true, Wilt didn't like this and they did have a falling out. However, they patched it up. And when Wilt died in 1999, prematurely at age 63, Russell was here in Boston about a month later at practice. And I had a, you know, acquaintanceship relationship with him. I'm not going to claim I was buddy. That'd be erroneous, but I knew him. And he told me that, yes, indeed, they had patched it up and that they spoke, if not weekly, but certainly monthly. And And he felt, you know, he was really crestfallen and taken by Wilt's death. And I said to him, so let me ask you this. Did you two guys feel like you were a member of a two-man club, the two-man fraternity, you know, just you? And he said, yes. That, yeah, he felt very proprietary toward Wilt and personally. So, yes, when Wilt died, he died as a friend of Bill Russell.
And he ends up being, you know, through the 60s, a big part of the civil rights movement as it came up there. I love the story of him sitting front row at the I Have a Dream speech and didn't want to be on the stage because he didn't feel like he was really part of the movement. But he had done a number of different things. There's the story of him going down to Mississippi and doing the integrated basketball camps down there after Medgar Evers had died, had been assassinated, rather. And he's just there for all these different movements. He'd been close to the Nation of Islam. What was the name they gave him? His middle name, X. And, you know, he just has this alignment with that movement during the time. And one of the things that I read is, you know, he loved basketball. He had this great basketball career. It almost felt like he wanted to be part of this bigger movement that was going on during the 60s as well during that time. And he does ultimately end up retiring. I don't want to say early, had a long 13-year career there, but he goes out on top. He's this champion. And one of the things I read is that, you know, he didn't have as much of a love for the game in the 60s as this movement's going on outside of basketball that he's pretty closely aligned with. And he's battling on the forefront in Boston and other places. You know, we mentioned the boycott and he had done one in college as well. And he just has this, you know, great, great association with the civil rights movement that ends up winning him the Presidential Medal of Freedom by the end of his life there. But what kind of things stick out from that part of his life to you?
He did his part. He was where you would think he was going to be. Selma, Alabama. He was at the places. He was where at the forefront of using his position and his moral authority. Oh, absolutely. No, it was part front and center. That's the more important. Obviously, part of his life. Go back to that line I told you is my citizenship is not a gift, it's a birthright. And that's the way he lived every day of his life, to fight for that right and to demand that right, those rights, whatever rights they happen to be. He was right there, and everybody knew it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so he has this complicated relationship with Boston, and it's really something we're still parsing through as he passes away this week, is what he really means, you know, as a Bostonian, as someone who lived here for so long, who did not have the best view of the city, and rightfully so, given, you know, the attack that he faced on his home in Reading and the lack of fanfare around the team and, you know, the taunts and everything else, whatever it was, wherever he went, he didn't love Boston. And, you know, the line, unfortunately, that I think sticks out most is calling Boston a flea market for racism. You know, that bold striking line. And, you know, he had kind of disassociated with the city. You know, I play for the Celtics. I don't play for Boston, all the different things that he said. And he ultimately didn't come back. Wasn't really a significant, you know, connection to the city long after he retired, despite this great, great career, 11 of the 17 banners hanging in the Boston Garden and then the TD Garden. And that's still something it feels like we're parsing through, is, you know, just how much love, how much respect the city of Boston gave Russell, given what he went through at that time.
He never really was able to embrace Boston. He could never get over the initial reaction, the way Boston was when he came. Things that we'll never know, what individual things that happened. We know the most famous thing that happened is someone broke into his house, as you alluded to, in Reading, and smeared feces on his wall. That's going to sour anybody. He famously said, I only owe Boston fans a performance. He famously didn't sign autographs as a rule. He didn't, but he moved about where he wanted to move about. And, he got involved in business, Slades and Tremont and at times, but no, he never, this wasn't a completely comfortable place for him. Other players of the time, Sam and KC, seemed to be able to negotiate it better than Wilt did, than Russell did, Satch as well. And when he came along, it didn't ever get a whole lot better. And Boston finally got around to giving him a belated tribute in 1999. It was a wonderful evening at the Boston Garden. Celebrities came from all over the place. Wilt flew in from California to be there. The MC and his prime and glory was Bill Cosby. And, knew his basketball from Philadelphia. He did it because it was able to be a fundraiser for the National Mentoring Partnership that he was very fond of and very important to him. But let me say this. Yes, he never really fully embraced Boston. He just didn't get off to a good start, never got to where it should have been. But do not, for anybody, I'm not saying you, do not confuse that with his love for this organization, Celtics. He totally and completely identified as a Celtic and loved red and said he could never imagine playing for anybody else or that he would have been as good as an NBA player for anybody else. And loved his teammates universally. Wonderful story this week by Adam Himmelsbach in the Globe. I'm so glad someone reached out to Rick Weitzman. People know Rick Weitzman from Northeastern and from his high school days coaching and from his broadcast days with the Celtics, who was a member of the Celtics in 67, 68 as a 10th round draft pick. Imagine that. Remember the 10th round out of Northeastern. And Russell befriended him Rick was overwhelmed by the fact that Russell had, befriended him. Not only the fact that he kept him as the coach on the team. He did get rid of him after 1 year, however, but Weitzman treasures that relationship. But he loved the Celtics. I just think he probably wished he could have airlifted the organization to Seattle. That's all. That's the city. That's where he wound up living for the last 40 years. It's irrefutable that the town, the town did not love him back. They loved the ball player. They loved number six, but he didn't think they loved Bill Russell. And even at times, I think, and like so many black people of prominence, they know that any treatment that they get is not necessarily going to be the same. It's going to be better than the treatment of an anonymous black person. That they're only getting that treatment because they are somebody. You can only play at this golf course because you ask some of the, I won't throw a name and name, but there's some other Boston athletes that would be happy to tell you that they've been allowed to do this or that. And they know damn well at the time that it wasn't going to be extended to an average black person who was not in a newspaper. And Russell was very well aware of that too. Don't worry.
And you mentioned the night in 1999, they re-retire his number. And I believe he got a big ovation that night. What was kind of the thinking behind that and having that second ceremony? Because no one was in the building for the first retirement, him.
No fans. He did it. They coerced him into doing it. They persuaded him to do it when he came in as a broadcaster. I was there. It was before the game and with only the media that were there and the workers in the garden. The staff, they happened to be there incidentally doing their job. And that's when he did it. And it was classic Russell. And just like he was inducted in the Hall of Fame without being there, as far as I know. He thought that they didn't do right by the black players at that time. He didn't think that they had done right. And he was standoffish with the Hall of Fame. I think it patched it up with him eventually, but at the time he resisted it. He was, this is the principle. This is called principle. And he had a principle. So he had principles and he lived by his principles. I cannot fault the man for that.
Yep, no doubt. And you got to know him most as that coach in Seattle, as you alluded to there.
When
you
were first broadcaster, when he was doing broadcasting in the 80s. And interacting with him there. He was a good source for me to do stories. I remember once I wanted to do a big feature. I was a big Maurice Cheeks fan, and I wanted to give him his due. And one of the guys I leaned on was Russell, the rhapsodizer about Maurice Cheeks, which he did for me. But that's where I got he once, I had a little social, interaction with him in terms of that All-Star game in Seattle 1 year. And he gave me advice on where to go eat and where to take my wife to do this and that. So I had that. That's as far as the relationship went with Bill Russell. He was in control of every relationship. He had a very firm boundaries on what he called on friendship as opposed to acquaintanceship. And you played by his rules. Everybody played by Bill Russell's rules, which is fine. I was very honored to be anywhere near in the orbit. Think about his concentric circles. I was probably about three rings out. But I was there. That was nice.
What was your favorite interview you had with him over the years?
Oh, Well, you know, I'd like to see it again. There's two things. 1999, we had this one night in Boston, and I did the setup story for the Globe in the morning paper, May 25th, 1999. And to get that interview, I was set up by the PR people, and I went to the Capitol Grill in Providence and had dinner with Bill Russell and the PR person. And I think his then wife, or I don't know whether they were married at the time, Marilyn or not. She since passed away, and he got married again. But anyway, that the woman in his life at the time, I'll put it that way. And we were there for over 3 hours, closed the place up, literally closed up the joint. We were the last ones in there. And he gave me his A game in terms of the stories and the anecdotes and the great lines, and gave me his A game. And he goes, you're probably well aware, he had the most famous laugh in the NBA, his cackle. Mm-hmm. They
called it a cackle. Yeah, you can't even imitate it. It's 101. No,
everybody knew his cackle, and he cackled. We kinkled into the night. It was a memorable night. The other one is, and I almost forgot I did this, and I guess it's out there, and I wouldn't mind seeing it. I actually did an interview for CBS with he and Red sitting at midcourt at the Garden. They aired and broke up for halftime during when CBS had the game of the week back in the 80s. I did it. And I forgot about this until somebody reminded me. I just the honor of doing that. I would love to see, I'd love to hear it again to see exactly, what we talked about exactly, specifically at that time. One thing I do think I do remember is him making it clear that playing for Red, if he hadn't played for Red, there wouldn't be 11 championships. Play for anybody else, there wouldn't be, period.
There was one other line he said about that I really loved, and it was Russell to a T, as he said, if I didn't have Red, I probably would have won 3 or 4 championships or something like that. And then he said, Red probably would have won 0.
Yeah. Oh, no, he was good. But he did really respect and love Red. And
yeah, I guess that'll be my last question. Is there a relationship, Red's decision to bring him in? Russell, over time especially, really valued what he did for him back then, because he said if he went to St. Louis, he wasn't going to play in the NBA.
Yeah, no, of course, there was always the option of the Globetrotters in those days, and they would have paid him more money, but that wasn't the kind of life that, he wanted to live. Wilt actually did it, the year before he was coming to the NBA, after he left Kansas after his junior year, and he couldn't get into the NBA because he hadn't been eligible for the draft yet. But in those days, the rules were very different. But anyway, I'm just honored that I had anything to do with him, because he's truly a great man.
He is Bob Ryan of the Bob Ryan and Jeff Goodman podcast here on CLNS Media Network. Appreciate your time here this evening. Appreciate all you've done to spread the good word on Russell this week. And of course, rest in peace to Bill Russell, dead at 88 this week. Legend in tons and tons and tons of different ways. We have an obituary up on CLNS Media. Of course, the Globe has had plenty of great coverage this week as well. And number of great tributes.
I'll get a plug in. I will have one final say in the Sunday paper.
Excellent.
I've got one point in on the Sunday paper. So I'm calling your attention to that.
Bob Ryan, the legend, Globe Emeritus. He'll be in the Globe on Sunday. Can't wait to read that. Bob, thank you so much for your time here today.
Good. That was very nice. Thanks for having me.